This is a Global Player original podcast.
Hello and welcome to Full Disclosure, a podcast project conceived entirely to let me spend more time than I'd ever get on the radio with fascinating people. This week's guest, Dame Sheila Hancock. I have tried this line with a couple of previous guests, but I think in your case it's especially pertinent. There's quite a lot to get through.
Well, as you're going to do my whole life. I mean, the thing is that I've forgotten most of it. So I'm not the best person to interview. I keep hearing things like I listen to Radio 4 Extra sometimes. Mm. And they do old plays. And I swear to God, I listened to an entire play, not being able to sleep, by 3 o'clock yes. in the morning. I thought, that's quite good. And at the end, it said, Judith was played by Sheila Hancock. I don't remember a single thing about it. And I'd have been in a terrible state when I did it, because I always got nervous about everything.
But you don't recognise your own voice while you're listening?
In fact, so much so. And then there was another one, an E.M. Foster series.
Yes.
Somebody phoned up and said, I'm really enjoying you in the Foster. And I said, no, that's not me, that's somebody else. And I tuned in. And I didn't recognise myself, much so that I asked my agent to phone them and say, I think you've put my name on something that I'm not in. Again, four-part series, and I don't remember a thing about it.
Good Lord. And just very briefly, do you remember Dudley Sutton?
Yes,
he told me a story many moons ago about, I think he was actually in hospital, and Only When I Laugh came on. James Bolam, and they were set in a hospital, and he phoned his agent and he was very cross because he said, why on earth haven't you put me up for this? It's perfect. It has a revolving cast. And his agent said, you were in the last series.
It is awful, isn't it? Somebody did a programme about me and I honestly had forgotten a lot of it, but you can't possibly, you learn lines. I think my brain, when I was in Weekly Rep, I think I had an automatic wipeout because your brain just can't take so much. I mean, Giles Brandis says it's all there. And if I ever forget things, he always makes me remember it because he says that all that's happened is you've got lazy about recovering.
Right. Yes.
But your brain is full of everything. So, mine must be crammed with the worst plays in the world.
Well, you have your own memoirs to consult now if you need to clarify anything.
That is true. I do that. I've been known to do that for dates. I have, really.
It begins on the Isle of Wight, but not for very long, I don't think.
No, I think I honestly don't know much about my childhood, and I've got nobody alive to tell me. But I think my dad was working there. There was an old hotel in Black Gang Chine.
Mm.
It's now a huge funfair place, but then it was just this rather isolated hotel. And I was born while he was working there. And then I think we left immediately and we went to a pub somewhere in Berkshire. But they claim me as an islander, they call it.
Yeah. Your dad was Italian. Originally.
He was born in Italy,
yes.
And he was given the name of Enrico, and the rumour hath it that Enrico Caruso was his godfather. And actually, when they did my Who Do You Think You Are, I mean, we thought it was laughable, but my granddad worked for, what's the big travel firm?
Thomas Cook,
who at that time were kind of like ambassadors.
Yes.
They were terribly important.
Yes.
And they took me on that programme to a place that they lived in Milan, which is an incredibly glamorous flat. And he obviously would have entertained a lot of people. So it's conceivable that Enrico Caruso thought, oh, God, if I'm going to get a good train, I'll have to give something, or say. I've got this little pot with his name on.
Family legend.
Yeah.
So he wasn't Italian. He was just born there.
He was just born there.
Oh, okay.
So but he spoke only Italian when he was little.
Growing up. Were you conscious of that when you were little?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't really. I mean, he was temperamentally not like normal people. So the fact that he had a name like Enrico, but of course they called it Rick during the war because it wasn't good to be Italian during the war.
Of course.
He was kind of melodramatic and operatic, and he used to sing in the bar, Pagliacci. Would you believe in King's Cross? Can you believe
this is where he had a pub?
Yeah,
latterly after Berkshire.
Yeah.
So is this where do your earliest memories kick in then? Because I think the war broke out when you were six.
Yes, seven.
Seven.
I can remember a pub that we worked in Berkshire. King's Cross is the one I remember the most because I was happiest there. It was lovely. And that's where they had a piano in the bar, and it was a real local pub. And actually, funnily enough, it's still not been turned into a smart okay. sort of thing. I mean, it's not like it was when I was there, but it's still got a public bar and a saloon bar.
Right.
Hasn't got the ladies' bar, but it's got some of the cracked mirrors. And I hope they don't change it, because there's very few of those left now.
Why were you happy there? What was it you liked?
I don't know. Just the atmosphere and the Salvation Army used to come on a Sunday, and it was a very working class pub. And I just felt we lived in the flat above, which is what we always did. We weren't allowed in the bar because
sure.
children weren't. I had to run through. But I just felt comfortable in that area. It was an incredibly friendly area.
You've got siblings. Are there siblings?
I've got a sister who was 9 years older than me.
Oh, okay.
So didn't really have much to do with her, yeah.
To you. And your mum didn't work in the pub, I don't think. She did. And also in a department store.
Yeah, but when they left the pub, I think Dad was too keen with the sort of have one on me, Rick, things. And we then moved to Kent.
Right.
And my mum worked in a shop in Erith, and a big store in Erith, and Dad worked in a factory.
Right.
In Crayford.
This is Bexley Heath. This is sort of suburban, really.
Yeah.
So quite different, buzz-wise.
Yes, I hated it.
Did you?
Hated it.
You remember hating it? I mean, quite young.
I remember hating, finding it terribly dull and having to behave, you know, because it was sort of semi-detached houses and you had to behave nicely, and I wasn't used to that, because in the pub I could do more or less what I liked, you know,
yes.
because my mum and dad worked all the hours at God's End. Mind you, they did when they were working in the shop and everything. But and I was a bit older there,
yes.
and then I was at grammar school, so I had a lot of homework and I had to work hard, so it was a different life.
Were you a good pupil? Did you like school?
I don't know about liking it. But I worked really, really hard. I was on a scholarship, because it was before you could go free to grammar schools. Mm. The Education Act came in just after I went there, so I had to have a scholarship to go there. And very few people got them. And we were a class of 50 at our primary school, and only 5 of us got to the grammar school.
Gosh.
And the rest all had to go to secondary moderns and techs, which were awful, absolutely awful.
Yes.
And, you know, I've done literary festivals. And I often talk about it, and I've had people come up and say, I remember that. I was one of the people that was bunged off to secondary modern, and I never got over it. You know, because...
So early, isn't it, to be judged?
Absolutely.
To be sifted.
Absolutely. That you were a failure.
Yeah.
You hadn't got your scholarship. And it's shameful.
Which was the aspirational parent then? Which one
I think
was...
they both were.
They were.
Both, because, I mean, looking back on them, they were... I mean, my mum would have been an amazing businesswoman, but she left school at, I think, 14. But, you know, when she worked in the shop in Erie, she started on the glove counter. And then she suggested to the man who ran it that they have a little library, because she heard that some shops did. So she set that up. And then she said, well, what about a restaurant? So they had a big cafe there. And I tell you who it was. It was Wendy Cope's father who owned the shop. Wendy
really?
Cope was a little girl there.
Good
yeah.
grief.
Yeah, but I always thought my mum, with no education at all, did all that. And it was her. It was her that really got it going.
So were you a sort of vessel, do you think, for her frustrated ambitions in any way? Or is that cod psychology?
She was very frightened always for me.
Right.
I remember getting a letter when I was out of work in London, and I was with my first husband, and I got a letter from her saying, you mustn't neglect your husband. You're not taking care of him in the way that you should. You're too ambitious.
Mm.
There are other things in life and your family and this, that, and the other. And they were very frightened. And rather sadly, I went through the records at RADA one day, many years later, when I was filming there. And there was a letter from my dad, written, beautiful handwriting and everything, saying, could you let us know whether you think Sheila has a future in this?
Oh.
Because we're a bit worried about where she's going to go. You
Gosh.
Know? And so obviously they were really worried that I wasn't going to have a solid
job.
From
a place of profound love and concern.
Yeah, yeah. And in those days, coming from that background.
Yes.
People did have jobs from when they left school
sure.
for life. Now,
yes.
everybody moves on all the time.
I mean, because for an outsider, you'd think getting into RADA would have been proof enough that you had...
Well, yes, again, a scholarship.
Yes.
Again, a scholarship. And I was very out of my depth there. They were right about that. But it was... I don't know. I think they weren't sure that I'd made the right choice. It seemed risky.
They can't write a cheque for you, though, can they? No. No one can, especially in your profession. No one can guarantee anything.
But these are the same people that after the war, immediately after the war, let me go hitchhiking all around Europe. So they must have been terrified.
So concerned for your long-term security, if not your short-term safety.
Well, they seem to be off evacuated.
Yes,
you know,
well, we've jumped ahead. Let's go back to that. That was sort of at the outbreak of war, really, when you were evacuated miles away from home. It's one of the sort of what was the story that John did, that your late husband did? Was it Uncle?
Mr. Tom.
Some of us probably rely more on fiction for understanding the experience of evacuation than we do on.
Yes,
fact and memoir.
We talked a lot about it when he did it. I told him what it was like. And
yes.
How it was. I thought it was wonderful, and I thought he was brilliant in
it. It's a superb piece.
Absolutely wonderful. Timeless show.
But you've said that the other children, when you got to Wallingford in Oxfordshire, the other children didn't like the evacuation.
Oh, they hated us. They hated us. I mean, I can understand them hating us. I mean, we had Cockney accents. We couldn't understand them, and they couldn't understand us. And We did have fleas, quite a lot of us. I had fleas. I got the cane, actually. They used to do flea parade, and teacher used to look at our hair, which she had a sort of glass thing. And she looked at our hair, and if you had nits, you had your hair washed in the cloakroom in front of all the other girls in a sort of carbolic thing.
Yeah, it would be.
Anyway, she wanted me to wash, and I pushed her and hit her, so I got the cane.
Were you quite a rebellious child generally?
I was just defending myself. Yes. I spent most of the time terrified, you know, but I...
Would people have known you were terrified? Would your exterior have been quite robust?
No, because I would fight them back, but I had a twitch. I had, you know, because of the raids, I think I had a really bad twitch, and they thought I was pulling faces to them. And just, I was very feeble looking. I was very thin, and so I was game. I mean, you know, it happens now. One of my grandchildren is going through a bullying thing now.
Oh dear.
And I think kids are pretty savage.
Yes, they can
We
be.
Have to learn to be civilized, don't we? I think our basic instinct is to be quite cruel. And what we have to do is learn to be kind.
But you're describing trauma, though, especially if you had a tick or a twitch. And in those days, it wouldn't have been diagnosed or treated or anything like that.
No, God, no. I mean, I get so fed up with all this. Oh, he's got PDSI or STIB or something. Yes. And he's taking lovely pills for it. And you think, no, he's just naughty. It's just big naughty. Tell him to behave.
And did you start behaving when you?
I did. I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for gangs now. I do some work with kids, and I got in a gang.
Right.
That was our defence, you know, and it was partly evacuees, but some of the naughtier local kids.
Yes.
I remember I told stories. We used to go to a haystack. I always did this game of, you give me three subjects, I still do it, and you make a story up round it. And I don't think anybody had ever done that to them. So they used to say, do you want to come and tell us a story? So you used to sit on this haystack and do that. So I got sort of friendly with them and a gang. And I have to say, I did shoplift. I did fight back. I'm a Quaker now, but I mean, I did. I remember one occasion, there was a thing called the crinny, which you had to run across a piece of green area. We're going to school and coming back from school. And that was where they used to wait for me and pounce on me, these local kids who hated me. And anyway, they got me one day, and they did that thing of forming a circle, and they push you from one side of the circle to the other until you fall over, and then a bit of kicking goes on. Anyway, they were doing that to me. And along came, and I've always doted on women like this ever since, a kind of middle class, rather lovely lady. Said, what's going on here? No, stop this. How dare you do that? Now, you come with me, darling. I'll take you home. Where are you living? And this woman absolutely rescued me.
Gosh.
And, you know, I've always had a load of time for women like that who get things done.
Yes.
It's rather like the post office story.
Yes,
now.
It is.
There
yes.
are generations of these solid ladies, usually in cardigans, who don't allow miss, you know, just do it. Just clean it up.
What were the couple you were billeted with like?
They were a very old couple with a little Pekingese dog that bit me. They had never had children.
No.
I was forced on them. They didn't want to take a billet. And I just landed in the house. And I don't think they knew what to do with this twitchy frightened child. And there were some cows, I remember, down the bottom of the garden, and I'd never seen cows, and I still am terrified of cows, and you should be terrified.
I know,
cows.
It's a great point.
They're bloody dangerous.
They really are, and every year there's a couple of terrible stories.
Absolutely.
People laugh when you say you're terrified. Cows are huge.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I say this to my family. Good. They all walk through and I say, you wait. I'm going around the edge. I go miles around. But anyway, it was all pretty awful, and then I dirtied the bed the first night I was there because there was this awful toilet at the end of the garden that I was frightened of, and... But eventually, I mean, you learn.
Yes.
Whatever happens, you learn. You learn to cope, and you learn who you can befriend with, and eventually...
And you found safety in numbers. That's what you mean when you say you have sympathy
yeah.
for gangs, is that
yeah.
you stop being a victim when you become a member of a group.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. And yeah, and you face it together. I mean, that's what we've got to do about everything. We've got to face it together. That's why, you know, Brexit and all those things have upset me, because we're talking division all the time. Mm. And this world is only ever going to be the perfect place I want it to be if we all talk to one another.
It's with the perspective of that you have, being born in 1933 and being old enough to know roughly what was going on in the water, old enough to be traumatised by it, old enough
absolutely.
To know that you've been evacuated.
Absolutely.
I mean, some of the stuff that you've written and some of the stuff that you've said about politics, it resonates with a sense of almost disbelief that we seem to have gone backwards
yeah.
in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, even after coronavirus, I thought, oh, God, this is wonderful. This is going to be a new beginning. We found one another again.
Yeah.
We're supporting one another. We're doing things together. And I do think that people are finding a voice now.
Yes.
You know, every weekend there are marches going on. The Iraq march was one of the biggest ones. Doesn't work because the government is still saying, the British people are telling us.
No,
they're not.
No, they're really
they're
not.
No. I don't know who they're listening to, but half the stuff, they're not. But, you know, I think my profession as well. I mean, it's amazing what's happened with that post office series. It's something that's been going on for years.
Mm.
I mean, I'm sure you've been following it in
yes.
private eye.
Yes,
I have.
Didn't touch
thinking, why hasn't
yes.
why isn't somebody doing something about this? And then you get one series on the thing. And I think it's our duty. I feel very strongly in our world that we have to start doing that.
So, well, some people were a bit sniffy about it. They were not about the drama, but about the failure of the public to appreciate the scale of the scandal until it was turned. I'm the opposite. I suspect you are as well. That's precisely what stories are for.
But nobody ever tells anybody the truth anymore.
No.
It's like almost everything in politics. You know, whenever we talk about taxation, I'm going to get nasty people saying things now. But if we only explain to people that, A, the whole lot are not going to be taxed because most people are not liable for taxes.
Of course.
But if we paid more in taxes, we wouldn't have to send children to private school. We wouldn't have to go to private medicine, as everybody is beginning to do now.
Yes.
And I went to a private doctor because I needed an urgent appointment.
Mm.
So that was the only way I could
see. It creates necessity.
Absolutely. Mm. And I think directly you explain to the public clearly and absolutely honestly. That's what happened after the war. That's what happened. We were wrecked after the war. Mm. We were bankrupt. We were tired. We had men coming back from the war and the prison camps absolutely destroyed. We had children trying to get used to men that they hadn't seen for years.
Right, of course,
and it was mayhem. But there was this vision. There was this vision that it could be better. And then the National Health happened. And my dad, who had TB, we could afford to go to the doctors. Do you know? And I got a lot of other people joined me at grammar school.
Right, yes.
So it change happened. And I think people would be only too willing to pay a few pounds extra in tax if we could improve our schools. Our schools are in a disgraceful state at the moment. And we are going to be cutting now. I hear on the latest thing on the radio is that the council tax, they're going to give some sort of generous thing in the latest tax things. But the councils are going to have to put up their taxes because they're paying for all those things.
40 MPs, Tory MPs today asking for their councils to get more money. It's funny how the
really?
World turns. Yes.
Really? Well,
were you ever tempted by politics, like more formally?
I was, but I couldn't follow a party whip. You know, I really couldn't vote for something I absolutely didn't believe in.
Mm.
And our political system as it is wouldn't work if you don't.
Couldn't accommodate.
If you're not loyal to your party, you know.
So you come back to London from Wallingford. That's roughly coincides almost with the getting into grammar school, getting the scholarship, yeah, going to grammar school. Yeah. When did the bug bite? When did the thespian bug bite?
Well, my mum and dad usually entertain in the pub, so I was used to that. My sister went to Italia Conti's, okay, and was in Enza during the war and was a dancer and a singer and everything. And so that was at the back of my mind. And the opportunities were so little when I was young for women of like me from my background, even though I went to grammar school and even though, dare I say, I was clever. And my teachers wanted me to go for something called a state scholarship at that time, which would have paid my fees to go to a university. And they reckoned I could get in. But I just thought it was school. And remember, there was no television in those days. So I didn't know what university was.
Right.
Honestly,
gosh,
I didn't.
It just sounded like another few years of school.
I thought it was more school. If somebody had had the sense to take me and show me Oxford and Cambridge and things, that might have changed things. But the only people I knew who'd been to university were my teachers.
Right.
Nobody in the world that I knew had been to university.
Gosh.
So I couldn't say what's it like to anybody.
And mum and dad wouldn't know either, really.
Oh, absolutely. No. No way. They were frightened of it too. So, you know, it's one of my biggest regrets that I didn't go, because I then, years later, I was a chancellor of Portsmouth University.
Yes.
And I just was so overjoyed seeing people arrive as freshers and see how they gained confidence and got to learn about the world. Some people coming from places that they'd never left when they were young.
Of course.
And suddenly they're meeting from people from all over the world and learning new things. And it's wonderful. But I didn't know what it was. And then I did. It's so shameful, but it's true. And I've told the story before and it's absolutely true. I was madly in love with this bloke called Alan Coast, who was one of the science six from the grammar school across the way. And they used to use our laboratories and come over. And this godlike man used to come over and use it. And I used to go by on bell duty, hoping that he would even glance in my direction, you know, but he didn't. And then I did St. Joan in the school play.
Right.
And a couple of days later...
The title role?
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah,
so we'll jump ahead a little bit then, because you must have... You don't get cast as St. Joan unless you've demonstrated some aptitude.
Well,
or did you?
I hadn't done a lot. We didn't do a lot. But I think I'd read sonnets and things in class. And my teachers, these are the same teachers that begged my parents to let me go to state school.
So, right, you are. University.
And I think they probably, like John, had the same thing. He had teachers that encouraged him because he'd never heard of RADA.
Beyond the horizons that you would otherwise have lived within.
Absolutely.
Gosh. So you did St. Joan. You smashed it.
I did St. Joan, yes. And I think I probably was quite good because people since, most of them have died now, but remember having seen it. And anyway, a couple of days later, bell duty, tap on the window, beckoned over, asked to go to the school dance by Alan Coast.
Wow. So you reached parts that...
Oh, what? This is my future. You kidding with that? Lovely blonde Alan Coast for the rest of my life. But then an awful thing happened because they did my Who Do You Think You... No.
Yes.
What's that thing where they tell you your life? This is your life.
Oh, yes, of course.
And they did my This Is Your Life. And I'd all bored John rigid about this bloke. I'd always said, you know, you're quite good looking, but
you're no Alan Coast.
He was so handsome. Anyway, lo and behold, he says, and now we see your early love, Alan Coast. And on came this slightly balding gentleman. And he was so deeply embarrassed, I'm sure he was. He was very game about it, awfully sweet. He was living in Africa and he'd been dragged over.
Really?
For this joke.
So no Adonis
anymore.
But
you know these terribly good looking... I've just been reading Death in Venice,
yes,
a marvellous book. And there's nothing better than a beautiful man, is there?
I know what you mean.
Well, you won't know.
No, but I do know what you mean. I think, have you watched The Bear yet? The TV show about the chef in Chicago. Oh, there's a very beautiful man in that.
Really?
Yes, he's just won all the Emmys. And there is something, there's a reason why they made statues out of them thousands of years ago, didn't they?
It
goes back far enough.
But he was breathtakingly lovely.
So apart from Alan Coast, did performing in St. Joan, did you find muscles you didn't know you had? Did you feel things you hadn't felt before? Was there a sort of moment of...
Yes, I suppose I would, but I've got a terrible confession to make that I have never really enjoyed acting because I've always suffered from terrible stage fright. crucifying stage fright. And it started with St. Joan.
Really?
Because I did one performance of it, and I think a lot of people said it was good.
Yes.
Which hadn't occurred to me.
Right.
And I remember years later when I worked for Joan Littlewood, who was a revelation to everybody, but I had a big success in a show called Make Me an Offer. Mm. Lots of reviews and things saying overnight bullshit and all that. And the following night, I was terrified, standing in the wings, absolutely terrified. And I felt these arms around me. And it was Joan, and she was saying, and she whispered in my ear, and she said, "Darling, you're in a nasty, dark forest full of beasts and frightening things, and on there is light and loveliness," and then shoved me on the stage.
Onto the stage.
And it was a wonderful thing. I've used it ever since when I've been scared. I think most actors who get stage fright, and most actors do get stage fright, is that we assume the audience are going to hate us. And certainly on first nights, we assume the critics are going to hate us.
Mm.
And Joan's thing was saying, no, actually, out there is love. And certainly in my entire career, I know that to be true.
Yes.
There is enormous love. It can change overnight if you say something wrong.
Of course.
But well, there is a generosity of spirit from audiences.
People want to like what they're
watching.
They do.
They've paid a lot of money.
You know, apart from critics, perhaps. Most people turn up wanting to enjoy.
They do. But then you're tortured with the thought that you don't want to let them down.
Yes.
I remember you've done it 100 times. And
yes,
you've got to make it seem it's
but
the first
they haven't
time
seen it
that they've,
times.
It's the they've first. Seen it. So it's quite challenging.
Where do you find the joy then? Where if you're frightened before, are you in a moment? Douglas Adams, the author, described it as throwing yourself at the floor and missing. You just sort of soar off into a place that you can't really visit in any other way except by being in the moment. I don't know.
I mean, when some nights a show takes off, for want of a
yes.
better word, and you're all of you, part of it. I think the thing I most enjoy is rehearsals.
Mm.
I love the exploration of a character.
And the collaboration.
Turning myself into a person.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And finding the feet and the head and their life and research. I mean, when people laugh about lovies, what they don't realise is that when we work, we go into people's minds in a way that the average person never does.
Mm.
So we have an understanding of how people are suffering and all that. So we're maybe a bit over-compassionate
or
sometimes.
Empathetic.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But I love that process, particularly with a good director and my fellow actors. I love all the laughs and the fun
yes.
for that. I like being in musicals better than plays because I like the band and I love the chorus and everybody. They're always fun to be with.
It's like being on an aircraft carrier rather than a yacht, I imagine. It's like there's stuff going on over
yes.
here and stuff. There's all
but
sorts
also
of...
you get these amazingly close relationships.
Yes.
And the minute the last curtain goes, it's over.
Yes.
But then 10 years later, you go, oh, we were in such and such together. Lovely. Hug, hug, hug. It's an extraordinary thing. I don't think it happens in any other profession. I don't think people in offices, on the whole, have scenes where they jump into bed and have sex on the first day of the office, you know, which is what we sometimes
do. Oh, I don't know.
I mean, on stage.
No, I understand. I understand. And I mean, for people who don't know, and there won't be many of them, you've done the lot. You've done the farces, the Carry On films, you're working with Joan Littlewood. I mean, The Pinter, The Shore, all of it. You've done the whole canon, really. But you've already mentioned, if we backtrack slightly, that RADA was not a happy experience for you. So there's no indication yet of what might follow.
It's never been the most important thing in my life. I mean, that's a dreadful thing to say.
Not really.
But I care so much about the world.
Mm.
Before I die, I want to do as much as I can to try and make it better for my grandchildren. But it's always seemed more important.
Yes.
And therefore, I mean, for instance, my best thing ever was when I was artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Tour. And we went to Belfast during the Troubles. Mm. We went to the mines during the miners' strike. And we were part of society. And we were doing plays that they didn't know, but were totally relevant.
Yes.
Doing Romeo and Juliet in Belfast at the height of the Troubles was the best thing.
Sectarian play, isn't it?
Absolutely.
When you think about it.
Absolutely. And when we finished, I think there was a silence of about 5 minutes. And then the audience just went mad and hugged us, and we all hugged one another. And it was amazing. That was what theatre is about. That's the best for me.
But you didn't discover that for a while. You didn't discover that sort of theatre.
I occasionally would do a play that I cared passionately about.
Yes.
And when I later came to Shakespeare, I didn't get Shakespeare when I was young because I was the wrong type. But when I did, that was a passion because he belongs to us and every child is entitled to him. And that was my passion.
It's another example of the insidiousness of that lovey stereotype, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because what you do when you sign people up to that stereotype is you deny them access to the things you've just described, not just to the poetry, but to the relevance.
At the moment, with all the cutbacks, the one things that private schools are not cutting are their arts and their lectures and their debates and all that. In the state schools, that's all going.
So the gap grows.
It's terrible. It's terrible.
And in fact, talking about pendulum swinging and the perspective you have, you've seen the class relationship with class with your profession change as well. It's swung back now to privilege, hasn't it?
Whereas, well, they say that. They say that a bit. But the privileged lads are pretty knowing, actually.
That's true, yes.
If you think of all of them, they're pretty committed
and they
guys.
And they can act. There's no doubt about that. But when you were at RADA, by dint of having a London accent, a Cockney accent, you were ostracised.
Absolutely. I couldn't give myself away. I spent years tacking around doing weekly rep and everything. I couldn't even get seen by anybody.
So why did you stick with it?
Oh, dogged thing. I didn't know what else to do, quite honestly. I could act, and I was useful for that, but I didn't know that there was anything else I could do. I didn't dream that somebody like me could write. I wrote my first book when I was 70, you know, and I didn't think that's what university does to you.
Yes, and private education.
Yes. It gives you the right to be who you are. If you're like me, I mean, you know, and it was worse when I was young, you know, all those phrases like little girls should be seen and not heard and, you know your place. My dad used to say that.
Did he really?
Know your place, Sheila.
Right.
You know. And
but you didn't.
I didn't eventually, but in front of him I did. but I don't know. I mean, I was lucky that I had slightly maverick parents, so that probably helped me. And the war probably helped me because it was so erratic and everybody's lives fell apart. But you'll find an awful lot of actors, their parents are either in the church or army. Lots of people in the army who have travelled around, been rootless. You know, if you say to me, where's your home? I've no idea. Honestly, I don't know which of the places I would choose as my home. I say London because I've been here longest.
Sure, but you've spent
months. But I was born on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, and months on the road in rep, films, doing stuff miles away
from
home.
But I love this country to death, and I really want it to get better and stop behaving badly.
You and me both. The next bit I'm interested in is this move from being unfulfilled and underused to finding both fulfillment and employment. I mean, for the public, the rag trade would be a big milestone.
Yes, that
there.
Was huge.
But I think on stage, did it start to happen before that?
Rattle of a Simple Man was a Cockney prostitute.
Yes.
And somebody, Michael Codron, wonderful impresario, he was one of the new impresarios because the whole of the West End was dominated by a tenant's hold.
Yes,
you know,
on the theatres.
And you couldn't, people like me just couldn't get a look in.
Be the same cycles.
Absolutely.
And circles. You see it on the posters, actually, don't you? Michael Dennison and Dulcie Gray and this and that. And
Claire Bloom.
Claire Bloom and everything.
And
yes.
You had to be really lovely and very ladylike. So lovely.
This grip began to loosen. That coincided, did it, with people like Albert Finney and Peter O'Toole coming up through RADA.
Yes.
So you missed that.
But it was mainly the Royal Court and Joan Littlewood.
Right.
Because
yes.
She began casting people like me and Harry Corbett and people like that.
And Barbara Windsor as well.
And Barbara,
I mean, completely defying all of
that. She thought we could play anything.
And she was right.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, going back to the St. Joan, I managed to get an audition with Joan down at Stratford East. Because I worshipped her work, having watched it. And I did my St. Joan the Bell speech with tears running down my face. And I heard this laughter in the stars. And I thought, what's going on? That's awfully rude. Anyway, she always wore a cap on her head, and she came up, and it's always a bad sign if it's pulled over her face. Right. And she said, "Darling, what are you doing? You're a clown. Oh, what are you doing? Let's have some fun." And then for the first time in my life, I was led into doing an improvisation, and I was made to feel I was funny and valuable and original, and it was such a break. Because one, I tried to conform. I was very tall. I'd always worn flat shoes. I was a just horrible London accent. I talk posh. I learned to talk posh. I dressed like I was supposed to dress as an actress and always looked dreadful. I wore hats and gloves when I went on the round of the agents. And do you know what I mean? I tried desperately to be what I was expected to be. Yes. And they did want you to be. Right.
But you couldn't.
I mean,
be
I got
that
sacked
quite.
By the BBC for standing up for myself. I wanted to do something because I did loads and loads of sitcoms at one time. Now Take My Wife, one was called, and Bedsit Girl. You can imagine, can't you?
Yes, I can.
You can imagine. And I was a sort of floozy blonde. And there was a party at the BBC where the head of the light entertainment department said, "Oh, madam keeps turning stuff down," meaning me.
Right.
And I said, "Well, you keep giving me rubbish." And he said, "Right, well, I'll give you half an hour to do with what you like." So there was a marvellous man called Barry Took, who was on the comedy thing. He said, "Well, do it, don't worry." And he knew about people that were coming out of Oxford and Cambridge, which was John and Graham and Peter Cook and all that. And we devised a show called Now Seriously at Sheila Hancock. And it went out very late at night. But then there was a sketch in it that I'd done in rep I'd done in review on the stage, but it was very extreme, a woman hating everybody.
Yes.
And the director said, "You can't do it, darling, it'll destroy your image." I said, "What image?" And he said, "Well, people like you and they won't want to see you." I said, "Well, I want to do it, please." And he said, "Well, I'm saying you can't." So I then went to the head of Light Entertainment and he said, "Well, if he says you can't, then you can't." And then I went to Hugh Weldon, who was the head of the BBC. And I said, "Please, can I do it?" And he said, "I'll tell you what, you can do it in front of the studio audience. If the studio audience like it, then it can stay in the show." And it went like a bomb.
Right.
And I didn't work for the BBC for 10 years.
Because you'd put noses out of joint.
Yeah, yeah.
So the director's watching it, hating the fact that it's going down well.
Yeah.
So that, and I think you would, there's a cute contradiction here, isn't there, Sheila, a bit? Because you portray yourself, I've got images of you terrified before you come on stage and feeling that you don't fit in and comparing yourself to other actresses and finding yourself wanting. But there are other elements of your story that portray fearlessness. Fearlessness.
I don't know that it's fearlessness because I do it anyhow. Do you know what I mean? I suppose that could be a wartime thing, couldn't it? That you had to. You were frightened, but you still had to go to school with your helmet on and be down the shelters, and you'd hear all this stuff going on overhead, and then you come up and just collect shrapnel. See, I got a machine gun bullet, you know?
Because there's no option. You can't take a day off from the war.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe it's that.
Yes.
But I have friends who really relish life. I mean, I'm a joke. We had book club yesterday. I belong to this amazing book club, and I'm quite the most ignorant of all of them. They're all
rubbish.
Very well educated
sure
women,
you're not. Yes.
And I love being with them, and it's great. But we cook a meal. Do you know what I mean? And I'm hopeless at that, and I get in such a state. It's as though the world's going to end. I'm so frightened that I'm going to do it badly, and I don't know. It's fear of failure, is it? I don't know.
I don't know.
You're right. It is a contradiction. But I so envy those people who love everything. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. But I often wonder whether or not they are as content inside as they appear to be outside. I don't mean that they're being fraudulent. I just mean that some people are just a little bit more open about their anxiety than others.
No, I think they
really... Some people are just living it.
They cherish things much better. Do you know what I mean? And
Yes, they do.
They've decided that they're going to like things.
I'm going to relish this moment.
Yeah,
and
they do.
This.
And yes. I'm not... I'm not at all superior about it. I genuinely envy them.
Yes.
I genuinely do, because I'm gnawing my fingers.
Worrying about something that might happen
next. I remember standing
next
to Millie Martin. We did The Night of 100 Stars. And the three of us, it was me, Millie, and somebody else, Liz. Oh, I don't know, but we were doing a trio. And I was quaking at the wings.
Right.
And she was going, And I said, are you not scared, Millie? She said, I wouldn't be here if they didn't want me.
It's a very good philosophy, isn't it, though?
And she was brilliant.
Yes.
And I was awful.
Rubbish.
No, truly.
Well, but it doesn't touch the sides. Other people's confidence doesn't... you can't just...
I'm awfully good for other people.
Right, you are.
If you needed a helping hand, if you were going to do an audition,
yes,
I'd get you through it.
Yes.
I bloody well would. I would rehearse you. I'd go with you. I'd give you the right words just before you go on.
What I need to hear, but
I would be fantastic
at
doing that, but not...
It's funny. Were you waiting? Did you know that during the sort of the more difficult years, the earlier years, did you feel that there was... A light at the end of the tunnel? Did you think?
No,
you really didn't.
No, I didn't. I honestly didn't think I was ever going to fit in. I mean, I remember being seen once. I did Separate Tables, a play by Terence Rattigan, and in the first one, I played a model, and I got hair pieces and lovely makeup, and that was at Bromley Rep, not the Rep now, but a tatty one. And anyway, somebody was in from the John Penrose office. And they summoned me to see the big man, the agent. And I put all my gear on and went there. And his face fell as I walked in. And he sat me under a lamp and said, well, the first thing we've got to do is a bit of plastic surgery. We
can't
have that nose and all that. And do you know, that was absolutely acceptable then. It really was. I mean, we didn't. Thank God now.
Yeah.
Hopefully, an actor would say, "Fuck off." Are you kidding with me? You know.
Surgery.
But now, they're standing up for themselves. But like I did, and that's a rather sweet thing happened when I did my play Rattle of a Simple Man.
Yes.
I had huge success, lots of prizes and everything, and they did the film.
And they
did. And Dion Cilento played
it. They didn't cast you.
And do you know? Absolutely, I understood. I didn't for 1 minute think that they would cast me because I didn't do films.
Yes.
I wasn't beautiful on film. I wasn't married to Sean Connery, all that. Years later, I got an invitation to go to Shepperton, I think it was, to have lunch with Muriel Box, who was the producer of it.
Okay.
And she said, Sheila, I just wanted to meet you and say I'm sorry. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, I should have cast you in Rattle. She said it was, I gave in to the money people and the show, and the film didn't work anyway. And she said, it's always, whenever I've seen you lately, you know, because I was beginning to do nice things. She said, I thought I didn't help her. I didn't help her.
So how did that make you feel? Was that vindicating? Or?
It was moving.
Yes.
Deeply moving.
Yes.
And I comforted him. And I said, look, I didn't for 1 minute think that I'd get it. I really didn't.
And as you say, you were starting to do nice things by now. Did it, you know that line in Gatsby about bankruptcy where it says first slowly, then quickly? Is that how your success happened? Was it first slowly, then quickly?
I don't count it as success, you see. I really, really don't. But yes.
Well, objectively.
I
could look at your Wikipedia page, all the things you've done, all the awards, the nominations.
I've done some.
Most objective measures of success, I think it's a word that fits.
I've kept working.
But also... good work, you know, with a few exceptions, like Take My Wife.
And now Take My Wife and the terrible thing I did, St. Trinian's. I did St. Trinian's thing where I dared to play the headmistress. I mean, Alistair Sim.
I
played it. And I don't know whether it was my choice or whether they maybe, but with a Dutch accent.
No.
And I went to the Dutch embassy to look at the accent and everything. And I can't believe it. Somebody sent an email recently, apparently, to a website saying, girls of the St. Trinian's, why?
Yes.
And I said to my PA, just say, the money.
But you also got lots of, and you did. You managed to sort of fulfil all of your enthusiasms, really, didn't you? So you went to Broadway with Entertaining Mr. Sloan.
Yeah.
You I think.
That was a disastrous flop.
Was it?
It was a success d'esteem.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was the review. It's etched on my heart. Throw this British cesspit back in the Atlantic.
Right.
It said. I mean, because it so shocked them, because Broadway was still very proper. And
yeah,
we were doing...
I'm looking at the year. I thought I'd misread it by a decade. I presumed it was 75, but it was 65.
Yeah, it shocked them rigid.
Well,
and then
do.
The Greenwich Voice, which was an alternative newspaper, took us up. And people like Tennessee Williams and all those people came and saw it several times. So it was the best experience. And then I got nominated for a Tony, obviously, because they felt ashamed. Mm. But we had a ball because we were these wicked people with this dirty play.
Did you start being kind to yourself? Is there a point where you thought, I know you've already said you don't consider yourself to have been a success, but you must have acknowledged that you were doing something right at some point. You must have, I mean, after Joan Littlewood gave you your wings, as it were, you must have felt...
But the trouble is that you have a thing where things are going well, and the next thing you do is a disaster, so you're back to square one.
Yes.
That's the nature of the business. That's what I'm always saying when people ask me if they want to go on the stage. Mm. I say you've got to be constantly able to pick yourself up and carry on if you want to earn a living at it. Because you can never, I mean, even Olivier was terrified he wouldn't get another job, apparently.
Well, I wonder whether you're psychologically quite well equipped for that then, with the tensions that we've talked about.
I think
about.
I am, because I don't have any pretensions. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
I'm not grand at all. So
yes.
I could quite easily go back to living in a bedsit. I wouldn't mind. Genuinely wouldn't.
I believe you. And you don't have a sense of entitlement, do you?
Oh, God, no.
Not even a tiny one.
Oh, God, no.
No.
Really, I don't. But, on the other, somebody asked me the other day, who has most impressed me?
Hmm.
And, you know, I realise I'm not easily impressed. I couldn't think of anybody. Attlee was the only person I could think of. And Bevan.
Yes.
Way back. But I couldn't, and that was only because I encountered them both in a way that was so shocking, amazing. But I'm not impressed by people.
No.
You know, most actors, if big stars come, or if you're working with big stars, like when I worked with Bette Davis.
Yes.
Everybody was, oh, gosh, we're working with Bette Davis. I was just fascinated by her. And I wasn't at all frightened to say, you're right, that was good, that bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever. Do you know
what I
mean? I
bet she loved that, didn't she?
She did.
Yeah.
She did. She did a close-up and I did the lines off. And it was amazing. She did her usual cigarette business and it was just pure Bette Davis. And I just said, oh, God, that was so good, Miss Davis. And she said, oh, thank you, honey. The highest compliment I ever get is printed. You know, so I know. And you thought, my God, no,
yeah,
nobody
no
is
ever,
too frightened.
No one
to
bothers
say,
anymore.
Exactly.
Her,
they don't say,
presuming.
You're really rather glorious.
I want to get to the books, but before we do that, I mean, it is a ridiculous gamut of everything that you've done. And we have no time to run it.
We're believing coming out of different holes, so I keep working.
But are there particular highlights for you, or is that actually a silly question? Because where do we start? We go from Annie to Cabaret. We do the.
Well, do you know? I'm enjoying being old. I'm enjoying not having to do a show every night.
Yes.
And people have recently been saying such lovely things to me, like you are. People that I respect, because I love your programme and I love your rage.
Thank you.
I love it. And so I was deeply flattered that you asked me to be on. I'm not impressed by you.
No, I should hope not.
But I like you.
Thank you.
Do you know, and I'm interested in you.
Yes.
But do you know what I mean? Some people spend their whole time saying, oh, my God, I saw so-and-so, and they blew their nose, or they said hello. And even, dare I say, the King and people like that.
Where does that come from for you, then?
I don't know. I have no idea. Because I should be servile coming from my background. Maybe pubs. Maybe my dad greeting everybody.
A great equaliser.
Equally.
Yeah.
You know, he was a very good landlord. Very good landlord.
Yes.
Great fun. And didn't matter who, he was lovely to the old guy who was there all day. He was lovely to the wives who got him.
But also he's the lord of his manor.
Yeah.
So you grew up oddly as
the princess.
Yes, sort of. I mean, not in any sense of
Sarah, yeah.
But in terms of, I could not be, in this building, I could not be any safer or more important.
That's
I'm the daughter
true.
Of the landlord.
Those poor ladies in the ladies' bar.
Yeah.
They used to, because I used to be allowed in this thing at the back where they had their port and lemons.
Port and lemon.
And I used to do the whole of Snow White and the Seven Little People. And of course, because I was a landlord's daughter, they couldn't say, do you mind? Girl,
excuse me.
We're having
to have
a drink
a conversation.
Here.
It's a funny one, though, isn't it? Because you clearly.
I honestly don't know where it comes from, but honest to God, I admire people's guts. I admire people, but I'm not daunted.
Mm-hmm.
By them, and I get angry with people who are daunted by people. Do you know what I mean?
I think politically it's absolutely tragic, isn't it?
It
when
is.
People think, I mean, it's like that know your place line that you heard from your
absolutely.
Dad. That, because people honestly, and that's how some truly awful people can end up
absolutely.
Receiving deference.
Can you imagine what we'll end up with if we don't have a king and queen?
No.
But
that's a very good point, actually.
But I did a lovely thing that the Princess of Wales, is she? Yes. Organised at Westminster Abbey. And it was at the time when we were watching the terrible things that had been going on at 10 Downing Street.
Mm.
And the church, the cathedral, was full of people who looked after children in some way or other.
Okay.
Charities, they were from all over the country, in Scotland and Wales and everything. Fabulous atmosphere. And the princess looked glorious. And we were going to meet her, a few of us, because we'd done a bit of filming. And there was a lady next to me who was a midwife who works for virtually nothing with people who can't afford it and all that. And she said, "Why, you're very nervous." I said, "Darling, why? You're every bit as important as her.
Yes.
And she wants to meet you.
Yes.
That's why you're standing here, because she knows what you've done and she wants to say thank you." And indeed, that's exactly what the princess did. She's sure. frightfully good with people.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And she looked glorious and it was just lovely. But that's, and I
don't get it.
I think it's a shame.
Yes.
Because they are trying to move into something different.
Right.
That we still love crawling to people.
The madness of it all.
Why do we do that?
I don't know why. I think, do we derive a bit of, we mistake hierarchy for stability. If you know where you slot into a system, then you feel wrongly, but it gives you a sense of stability.
Maybe.
It keeps the madness at bay. You know, the chaos,
maybe.
The chaotic nature of existence can be kept at bay by the thought, no, I fit here, and she fits there, and he fits here.
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't
That's
know.
Like that sketch that
Yes, it is, isn't it? Yeah, the John Cleese one.
But now what is disturbing is that the values are becoming distorted,
yes.
aren't they?
Yes,
you can become
so.
A famous person on the web because you've got a big penis or something.
Yes, so
or,
I hear.
Do you know what
yes,
I mean?
I do.
Or you.
I wonder if it was always a little bit like that, though.
People just wasn't so much.
Well, we've always been able to achieve celebrity for spurious reasons, but
yes.
just not as easily or as bigly as you can now. When then did you start sort of spreading your wings? Because you mentioned you wrote your first novel at 70. People
yeah.
will also know you from Just a Minute on Radio 4 and doing lots of other things that actually, now that I've listened to you, that they speak more to someone who perhaps had been to university or had been to, it's as if quite late in life, you became an undergraduate almost.
Well, I think that's true. I did an open university. I didn't do the whole course, but
right.
I did some of these early courses when the children were young. And I'm avid to learn. And I love that I am daunted by.
Right.
I'm not. I'm impressed by
okay.
great knowledge.
Learning.
And I respect
yes.
hugely. And I want to meet
yes.
people like that. And I want a bit of them to rub off on me. Do you know what I mean?
And is that how you found yourself in those sorts of circles? Then?
I suppose it is, yes.
And then someone at some point said, "Have you ever thought of writing a novel?" And you said,
"Yeah, somebody did say that." And it was writing about the tour, about
yes.
the Royal Shakespeare tour. a publisher said, that sounds like, I just was telling him, you know, the cast was so amazing and the things that happened were so amazing. And he said, I think there's a book in there.
And there was.
I don't.
How many books have you written now?
Five, I think.
Yes.
Five.
The most recent of which?
Is Old Rage.
Which is a misnomer.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
Really? I think you were nodding to Dylan Thomas as opposed to a sort of angry old woman type of.
Yes.
Which you're not.
I'm not really, no. I'm not. I do get angry.
Yeah, but about good things. It's not a sort of inchoate fury. Well, there's another tension here, isn't there? Because you don't care about status, we've established.
No, I don't think so.
You do worry about what people think. But you worry about what a sort of unidentified person thinks as opposed to a real person. Because I know, because we've talked about stage fright and we've talked about not fitting in. And I know that I've read one interview where you were a bit uncomfortable with the interviewer mentioning some work that you did with Ukrainian refugee children because you didn't want to come across as being holier than thou. So you're worrying about someone else's opinion there when you really shouldn't be. And yet you can stand in a congregation with members of the royal family telling the person next to you to get over themselves.
Yes.
That's strange.
Yeah, I don't add up. That's true. I am even less added up now than I was when I walked in the room.
And when you write, particularly Old Rage, you put it all out there, don't you?
I believe in being honest.
Yes.
I've just written. I do a monthly column for the Prospect magazine.
Yes, I know.
And I've just done one about the royal family, fessing up.
Yes.
That I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Republican, but I do like the present royal.
And as you say, be careful what you wish for.
Yes.
Absolutely. Because what we might end up with
instead. And
particularly
when you look at the sleaze that's happening in politics, it's just nice to have something a bit fresher. And there are always people who say, oh, yeah, but what about the inequality and all that? Yeah, I know all that.
Yeah.
But if you're a little girl who lived through the war where the princesses were nice to you and sang songs to you on the radio and all that, then it's hard to shake that off. It's hard to forget about it.
You're also quite hard on yourself in the book, particularly on your mothering, your period as a mother. Does that cathartic writing that? Are you trying to make sense of stuff that's gone?
No, I'm trying to be honest because you know I anything I write goes past my girls, and I have to be honest about it. And they have turned out to be really wonderful mothers as a result. So it hasn't destroyed them. But I think when you write. I think in life generally you have to be honest, even if it reflects badly on yourself, I think.
Yes. Otherwise, what's the point?
Well, people don't believe you when it's important that they should, if you do that, you know.
We're nearly out of time. I just struck by a couple of things. The first is that I've interviewed a lot of actors. They don't have that much in common, oddly. Actors.
No.
You'd think that they would, wouldn't you, from the outside?
Yeah.
But you don't really have a look at me, Jean, do you? You don't. I mean,
no.
The only point at which I thought you might was when you were telling me about doing Snow White in the ladies' bar at your dad's pub. But you don't need the adulation by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I honestly don't. So, I really don't think I do. And I'm worried by it sometimes because people do say lovely things to me and say I'm an inspiration and all that. And I need them to know that I hobbled here this morning. I'm not this amazing woman who climbs mountains. I'm actually somebody getting old and bits are falling off and I'm not enjoying a lot of that. So, you know, I know sometimes when I've been in pain, and somebody comes, and you know, often when you do a broadcast or something, they say, oh, it's very lighthearted. Do keep it light, Sheila. Yeah. You know, we don't want any serious stuff because people, you know. and you get this person like me coming on and saying, oh, what a wonderful day and everything. And you're sitting there going, oh, Christ, my knee hurts. And you think, oh, be quiet, you stupid actress. Shut up. Shut up. That's what I feel.
And I can't believe I'm asking you this question, but I sense that there's still some stuff you'd want to do.
Oh, God, yes.
Like what?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, I don't know where to begin. I'm in such a panic about
the state of the world.
Well, I want to do more classical music. I'm so upset because it's such a passion in my life. I'm so upset that children are being taken more and more away from it. Sheku was on doing Desert Island Discs, and he was talking about that, you know, because his family have done so much to open up to certain people. But it's a joy that I want everybody to have the opportunity of turning down if necessary.
Yes, of course.
And so any work I do, I want to try and do that, that encourages people to at least try it. I'd love to do, just for my own fun, I'd love to do a couple of tiny parts. I've done a couple of small parts in wonderful television series, and I've been proud to be part of them. But I've only had about a week's work on them, and that suits me fine.
Right, yes.
Quite honestly, I'd love that. Just for my fun. And also, if we start doing some serious plays, which I'm hoping that we will now be doing some more campaigning stuff.
Yes.
Because it's going so well. For my own satisfaction, I need to learn more about classical music. I need to know more about art. There's a painting that I desperately want to see that I've got a print of, and it's in a gallery in America, and I don't know whether I can get over and see it. Do you know what I mean? Silly little things. I had a wonderful weekend just recently that I planned that a friend of mine is a young conductor for the Bournemouth Phil, and Sheku was playing a Shostakovich thing, and they invited me to the rehearsal. Darling, I was, talk about worshipping people. I was like a terrible fan. I was, all these musicians, all they wanted to do was go home and have their sandwiches. You know? But I'm there going, oh, that's so marvellous. Wasn't that wonderful bit, that phrase? Blah, blah. Anyway, and then I travelled to where they were doing a concert the following night, and I was there at the concert. So I was like a fan, like a pop fan.
Oh, I love that.
And I want to do more of that. I want to do more of that. I want to be more going to wonderful events.
So constantly conscious of how much there is to learn.
To learn.
And how much there is to do.
Absolutely. The books to be read. And
and written.
Yeah, well, I know. I don't think I'll be able to write it. I haven't got time. No. You. I mean, it's that awful thing, you know, like the book club. If we have a toast, it's our 18th year, I think. Here's to the next 18. And I'm thinking,
I love that.
I'm sorry. I don't think so.
Well, I disagree. Well, I mean, who knows if anyone can.
Yeah.
Here is. That's it. Sheila Hancock, thank you.
Well, thank you.
This is a Global Player original podcast.